Grab your Bibles and open them up to Psalm chapter 1. As Derek is away on sabbatical, you're going to have a variety of different pastors coming and preaching from two of the wisdom books of the Bible, Psalm and Proverbs, which is fitting because these two books were also written by a variety of different people. So Psalms is a collection of writings from numerous different authors. You'll see at the top of different chapters, Moses mentioned, Asaph, the sons of Korah, Solomon, Ethan, Heman, David. There's many other that where the author isn't known, which includes chapter 1 that we're going to look at today. And so all of these different authors wrote, and these authors were not contemporaries. The Psalms were collected over a period of a thousand years for them to all be written and compiled. And so what all these bring us, all these songs, is this rich mix of emotions, struggles, and celebrations. The Psalms are supposed to show us how we experience the world. We're supposed to relate to them in that way. Now, Proverbs also has a number of authors. It has three stated authors, Solomon, Agur, and King Lemuel. Along with this, it is generally assumed that those that are attributed to Solomon did not actually all come directly from Solomon, but that they were collected together, their kind of Jewish wisdom from throughout time. And all of this is given to us to kind of give us a description of how to navigate life as people committed to God and His way in a world that is not. And if you read through the Proverbs, you'll see everything is addressed from business to family to how to interact with celebrities and everything else in between. It gives us sort of this guide for how we can navigate this world. And so as you see this, one of the things that you will see about the wisdom literature is that it is not boring. A few years ago, you guys here went through Ecclesiastes. It's one of the other books of wisdom in the Bible. That's the search for purpose and meaning through all of the different ways this world offers us. Job, one of the other wisdom books, is all about suffering from the viewpoint of the sufferer as well as his friends and from God at the end. Song of Solomon, another wisdom book, reminds us that love and emotion and romance are all part of God's design for this world. And all of these are to give us different parts of what it means to be human, right? Suffering, emotion, wisdom, purpose, romance. The wisdom books are not then just for us to study and learn from, they're for us to feel. They're really, as we read through them, something where you're supposed to sort of resonate with them. They connect the very real complexities of living in this world, and they do so in a way to orient us to God. What all of this leads to is that wisdom literature is different from the other parts of the Bible. And if you try to read the wisdom literature in the same way that you read the other parts of the Bible, say the Gospels, the Epistles, you're going to come away with less than what it is meant for, or you're just going to be confused. And I'll be honest, a lot of the wisdom literature people read, they just go, I don't know what to do with that, because they're trying to read it in a very specific way. And so, since I'm going to preach through a psalm today, I'm also going to do a quick intro to the Psalms, and I'm hoping that with a little bit of background, this will be helpful for you in the coming weeks as other people come in, that you can get an understanding of how they work, sort of the context of them, to help you engage and understand God. And so, I'm going to do some heavy lifting today. It's going to get a little technical at times. I apologize for that. Just stick with me. We'll pull it all together at the end, I promise. All right, so we'll start with the structure. What is the structure of the Psalms? There's a theologian named Walter Brueggemann. He has described the Psalms as a process of orientation, disorientation, and reorientation. So the idea is that the Psalms orient us, that they give us a guide, show us the world as God created it. They describe sort of the world through God's lens. There's then also disorientation, where the Psalms reveal to us how this broken world undermines God's good order. And then reorientation, where they help us to figure out what it means to trust God's goodness with the reality of the world that we live in. And this journey from orientation to disorientation to reorientation is not just the structure of this book or even some of the individual Psalms. It's sort of the structure of our lives. Right, think about it. We get an idea of who God is, whether that is from someone else, from reading our Bibles. We sort of build our life up on what that means. And then life punches us in the face. Right? I don't know if you're in that season right now, but there's times where you're like, I've got it all figured out. And then something happens and you're like, I don't. And then we need to figure out, how are we going to come back? How are we going to make sense of what's going on? And that's the reorientation part, right? So we're oriented, we're disoriented, we're reoriented, and Psalms are here to help us through that process. And it's important to know this because I think too many people think that the Christian faith is supposed to be that we sort of get answers and just kind of build forward. If we get the right ideas, everything's going to fall into place. And when that doesn't work out, we feel like there's something wrong with us or there's something wrong with God. But the truth is, God designed this process of sanctification. Right, this continual process of disorientation and reorientation. That is what our lives ultimately are supposed to be. And while not all aspects of disorientation are as earth-tilting as sort of when you first figure out what the gospel means or experience grace, our lives are filled with moment after moment of disorientation, and some of them can be quite extreme. There are times when you think that you know who God is or how he works, and then something happens in your life that makes you go, this isn't how it's supposed to be. And so all of this makes the Psalms very practical. They're not just presenting us with a range of emotions because misery loves company, right? Or just because David is like, man, I'm having a bad day. I might as well write another psalm. Right? No, the Psalms present us with these very common experiences, the same things that we feel, so that we can see them as stepping stones to reorientation. Right? The Psalms are sort of like a pathway through the fog of life. And our desire would be for God to just lift the fog and for everything to be easy, but that's not how it works. God doesn't lift the fog, but he says, I am there with you in it. I'm not going to leave you on your own. I'm going to show you how to get through this. And again, the Psalms are one of his graces to us in the middle of that. For this reason, then, the Psalms are meant to be interacted with again and again and again over time. As a matter of fact, they're meant to be sung again and again over time because that's ultimately what they are. They are Psalms of praise. And so instead of information to just be gathered and stored, the Psalms are this book of praise songs that act as this reorienting force as we navigate the situations and struggles of the human experience. And the destination point for all of this is guiding and reorienting us to praise. All of this is bringing us back into relationship with God so that we can be the worshipers that he created us to be. And so the Spirit, through God's word, is transforming us. And he uses the Psalms, this repetitious connection of our experiences, to bring us back into praise and worship. Now, to get the benefit of the Psalms, it also helps if we understand what we are reading. What we are reading is Hebrew poetry. And so what we're going to do today is we're actually going to spend a little bit of time learning about Hebrew poetry. I know you're excited, right? But what we're going to do is we're going to go through the first psalm, and I'm going to point some things out for you along the way. Again, hopefully then as you continue to have other psalms brought to you in sermons here over the next few months, also as you read your Bible on your own, you have a good understanding of what it is and kind of the outline of it. One simple definition of Hebrew poetry is Hebrew poetry is a type of literature that uses parallelism and imagery and high frequency. So ultimately, those are the two things we're really going to look at, parallelism and imagery. As I said, as we go through, we're going to point these out. Let's just get into it. Psalm 1, verse 1. I've talked enough as the intro. Let's get into the text. It says this. It says, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on this law he meditates day and night. Now, the first thing that you will notice is that this is not like a normal paragraph. There's all these short lines that are sort of indented from each other. Again, it's not the normal type of writing that we are used to. And all of these are actually formatting cues for us. They're breaking this down so that we can understand. Actually, there it's not broken down, so that's unhelpful. If you have a Bible, look at your Bibles, please. You will see kind of the first line sets out, the next one is indented. And so what this is doing is actually breaking it into pieces for us so we can understand how the poetry works. So there's three main parts of this. The first is what's called the colon or the stitch. And that's a phrase that is represented to you by a single line of text in your Bible. I'm going to call this a phrase from here on out, number one, because I like that word better, and I don't want to be saying colon for the rest of the sermon. Second, we have a line. A line is a group of two or more phrases, actually, one or more phrases. We will see a one-phrase line later. That's what's represented by the indentation. So when you have one line out, and the next one's indented, the next one is indented, and then it goes back out, those three lines, the one out and the two indented, that makes up one line. Those all go together. And then you have what's called the strophe, which is a group of lines gathered together. And what separates those is a double return. So whenever you see those spaces between a section, I'll just call that a stanza, those all go together. So to describe it sort of in relation to grammar, a phrase is like a clause, like he goes to the gym. A line is like a sentence, he goes to the gym because he is concerned for his health. A stanza is like a paragraph. I'm not going to give you a whole paragraph, but the idea is they make up the whole thing together. Now, you don't have to remember all these terms, but I want to point them out to you because the meaning in Hebrew poetry is always going to be related to how these parts, they relate to each other, right? How the phrases relate to each other in a line and how the lines relate to each other in a stanza, that is where the meaning is found. This relationship between the two is what is called parallelism. Now, to make it even a little more complicated, there's different kinds of parallelism, so it's not always working in the same way. There's synonymous parallelism. That's where we see them sort of two lines saying the same thing. They'll say it just slightly different. Synthetic parallelism is where they will build on each other. So one says one thing, the next adds to it, the next adds to it, and we're sort of building forward. We have antithetic parallelism, where one thing is said and the next verse contrasts with it. You see that a lot in Proverbs. Where it's looking at the same thing, but from the completely opposite direction. So it's telling you the same thing, but in a contrasting way. And then you have what's called climactic parallelism, and that's where it sort of builds throughout up to a point where there's all of a sudden a line or a phrase that basically releases the tension. It's usually a celebration of God's goodness. It's usually when David is going, everything's hard and my life is terrible, but God, you are wonderful. It kind of builds up and then releases. So as you read the Psalms, you sort of have to ask yourself the question, how do these parts relate to one another? Rather than just moving through it real quick, you kind of go, what is being said? So with all that, let me read the first two verses one more time. It says, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the wicked, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. So what we have here is three lines made up of two phrases each. Now the first phrase here is the main point, right? The whole point of this first stanza is blessed is the man. Now the concept of blessedness is not just someone who has been blessed a lot, who has received a lot, but someone whose life is balanced and put together and content. They have everything that they need. So when the author says, blessed is the man, they are speaking about sort of what is really, I think, our greatest human desire, right? To be at peace with ourselves, to be at peace with the world around us, to sort of just understand who we are and where we fit, right? It's the confidence that you are enough and that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, which is a really catchy first line because you read that and you're like, yeah, I want that. It makes you want to read on to go, okay, if this is going to tell us how to be blessed, I'm going to read ahead to go, I want to know what brings about this sort of blessedness. And so it tells us. It says, who walks not in the counsel of the wicked. Now, that doesn't really tell us how to be blessed as much as how to avoid not being blessed. And so we see this is what's called climactic parallelism. It's building forward. It's setting us up for what is to come. So it's hinted at how not to be blessed, and it forces us to read on then, and this is what it says. It says, nor stands in the way of sinners, nor sits in the seat of scoffers. Now that's synonymous parallelism. It's saying a very similar thing. They build on second phrase from the first line to create a picture of all the things that prevent us from experiencing life as God intended. So it says, what gets in the way of being blessed? Taking counsel from the wicked, standing in the way of sinners, or sitting in the seat of scoffers. So let's look at those for just a second and think, what might that look like in our own lives? How might we actually be preventing ourselves from the sort of blessedness that the psalmist is speaking of? So taking counsel from the wicked. Who are the wicked? Well, the wicked are actually anyone whose good and bad or right and wrong conflicts with what God says is true. Now, the tricky thing about wicked counsel is that it doesn't sound wicked. As a matter of fact, for wicked counsel to actually be effective, it actually has to be convincing enough for us to believe it. It has to be the kind of direction that we want to believe. Not only that, it sort of has to come from someone who we already deem trustworthy. I always say, like, if Satan comes up to us and goes, you know, with the horns and the tail, and it's like, hey, you want some crack? Most of us know the answer to that question, right? We're like, not tricky enough. But that's not usually how it happens, right? Usually it's friends who are trying to help us out, an article by the author we like, or a celebrity we appreciate siding with our point of view. That is what wicked counsel looks like for us. Now, this isn't to say we shut out all of these things and don't listen to anything ever, but those things should never be our source of truth. They should all be, and they must be, weighed against God's order. If not, we will all begin to follow the latest idea or the latest PhD study over God, and we'll prevent ourselves from actually experiencing the blessed life that is promised here. So that's the first one, taking counsel from the wicked. Second thing it says is standing in the way of sinners. Right, that's the second barrier to us, kind of showing us that there actually is a sinful path. There is a way that we should not go. I always say, wouldn't it be nice if all we had to do was to sort of avoid some major highway and everything else was kind of open and we're like, oh, easy, just avoid over there. But instead, the path of sinners is every path other than God's way. Right? It's living any way that is in contrast to what God has said is true and good, which is a bit more complicated to avoid because it means there's lots of those paths. This would simply imply that God's way is a narrow, or this would imply that God's way is a narrow path. Maybe you've heard that before. Right? That's how Jesus described it in Matthew 7. Right? Enter by the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction. Those who enter it are many, for the gate is narrow and the way is hard that leads to life, and those who find it are few. So what this means for us is that standing in the way of sinners is going to be the path of least resistance. It's easy to find the path of destruction. All you have to do is just sort of follow yourself, follow your own wisdom, follow the world around us. It'll just sort of take you in that direction. And so if you aren't specifically striving towards God, if you aren't thinking through, am I doing what he says is true, you're going to get caught in one of these other paths. And the problem with these is not just that they're bad or that they're wrong, but that they lead you away from the blessedness that is promised here. They lead you to destruction, Jesus says. Now, just like the other, these alternative ways never look bad. Right? Many of these paths are exactly how we are told in this world, we will be happy. They are really the results of wicked counsel. But what we need to remember is, even when something looks wise to us and is being told by someone that we think we can trust is the way to go, human beings do not have the ability to balance all of the variables. The wisdom that we get from God has taken into account every possible outcome. We can trust it because God is eternal. He is omnipotent. He knows everything and how everything will bear out. His is not just an opinion where we go, okay, we should measure that against other things. His way is good and right and true. And so to stand in the way of sinners is trading a long-term blessedness for a more immediate sense of good. We follow our own wisdom away from God. Third thing he says is sits in the seat of scoffers. This third barrier, I would say, is a lot more aggressive than the first two. It isn't about sort of passively following wrong counsel or living based on a false sense of what is good. It's actually being hostile towards God's way. To sit in the seat of scoffers is to believe in order to put yourself in a place of authority over God. To basically say, God, prove it to me. You need to answer my questions. It means you internalize the wicked counsel. You trust in the sinful way to the extent that God's option now becomes offensive. God has to answer to you. For the person who takes this view, then they sit in the seat of authority and declare that God is not just wrong, but God is evil because his good gets in the way of what I think is good. This person becomes distorted by their trust in wicked counsel and their practice of the sinful life. And they've deemed themselves now ambassadors of the truth, and in this they attack God. And this is happening all around us. There are a lot of people who grew up in the church who are now the most vocal advocates for basically tearing down God and really scoffing at him. The reason this is a barrier to blessedness is not just that mocking God is, again, bad, or that it's not going to make you happy, but also that God will simply not submit to you in your seat. God isn't ultimately interested in meeting your criteria or being accepted by you. He is God. And we need to recognize this. We have a very low view of God. Our view of his holiness and his otherness has been diluted. And we sort of think like, we're all lovely, wonderful people. God should want us all. And so he should come to us and make... That's not how it works. He is God. And God will survive your mocking. But you will not find him unless you get down off your perch and let him lead you. This will keep you from being blessed. Being right or thinking that you're right will keep you from being blessed. All right, so far the psalmist is focused on the negative. He's shown us what not to do. We need more than that. So he goes on now to start to offer us what does it look like to pursue the positive. This is what he says in verse 2. He says, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on this law he meditates day and night. Now the he here, or the his, is the blessed man, right? So we're back to talking about the blessed man and how it is that he is receives God's blessing or gets a blessed life. We've seen what a complete man does not do. Now we actually get to see some of the positive movement. It tells us that to be blessed is to delight in the law of the Lord. And it says that you find that delight by meditating on it day and night. So the path to finding your place in this world is to not just know God's law and obey it, but it says to delight in it. The only way to find delight in rules is to see them as the path to blessedness. Now, this sounds like circular reasoning. Right? To be blessed, you have to delight in the law, and to delight in the law, you have to see it as a means to blessedness. And actually, it is circular reasoning. And what it's telling us is that in order to actually do this, in order to actually interact with God like this, you have to jump in. You have to enter into his worldview. You can't sit and wait until you're completely convinced or until it all makes sense or until there's no risk involved. Faith requires us to trust before we are absolutely 100% sure, knowing that there's always going to be part of us that will doubt. There's always going to be part of us that is fighting against what is actually best for us. But God created us to be fulfilled. And Christ has made it possible for us to find this blessing. And we have been promised a full and complete fulfillment in the future. This blessedness is actually attainable to us. And so our part now is to trust in him more than we trust our doubts. To believe that God actually knows what is best for us, that he actually wants what is best for us. That when God says to do something, it's not just to go, I wonder if they can do it. He calls us to obey him because that is what will bring about blessedness. And to drive this point home, the author of this psalm is now going to use some vivid imagery. Verse 3 says this. It says, he is like a tree planted by streams of water that yields its fruit in its season. Its leaf does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away. So we have four lines here. Three of them have two phrases, and one is actually a what's called a monophrase at the end. At the end of verse 3, it says, "In all that he does, he prospers." That is a phrase that stands as a line on its own, and that is the point of this whole stanza. In all that he does, he prospers. Now, the rest of this is a comparison of the two paths mentioned earlier, right? The way of God and the way of sinners. The way of blessedness and the way of destruction. But instead of paths, they're now presented to us in a different picture, a tree and chaff. Now, we said before that Hebrew poetry is defined by two characteristics, parallelism and imagery. We talked a lot about parallelism. We can stop talking about parallelism for a minute. I want to spend a few minutes on imagery. Right, in one sense, imagery is obvious. What is imagery? Imagery is when one thing is used to represent something else. But for imagery to be effective, we have to experience and understand all three parts of the imagery. The three parts are, number one, the topic. That is the what is being described or the issue that is at hand. The second is the vehicle. That's the image that is being used to describe it. And the third is the tenor, and that's what connects the two, right? The commonality of the topic and the vehicle that sort of is going to make the point for us. And this honestly is where the Bible can sometimes really be hard for us, because there's a lot of times where God is describing a specific issue and he's using a vehicle that is culturally rooted in, I mean, a lot of it's farming practices. I don't know how much you guys know about farming, but there are times when we read this stuff and we're like, I'm sure somebody understands that. And that's where it's the job of people like me to get up and sort of explain what that means. But we just need to know that if we don't understand the vehicle, we're not going to be able to understand really what the whole image is pointing us to. Now, in this case, the thing being described is the blessed man, right? He is like. And the vehicle is the tree. That is what is being used to describe him. The tenor then would be what connects the man to the tree. And so it says that the way of the blessed man is like a tree, specifically a tree planted by streams of water, in that it prospers. Why would a tree next to a stream of water prosper? Right? The roots go down, and there's always going to be a water source available. I don't know if you've ever tried to grow a tree or to grow plants, but you have to water them a lot, especially when it gets hot and dry. You're constantly having to pour water on them, or else they will dry out and they will die. But a tree that's by a stream of water has a continual source of being fed. It will never go dry, and that's why the promise can be made that its leaf does not wither, and all that it does, it prospers. It will bear fruit because it is being fed from something outside of itself. Likewise, the blessed man finds his strength from the bottomless source that comes from within. Not from himself, but has been given to him in the Spirit. Having this source makes the blessed man impervious to the storms and the droughts of life. He is filled in spite of his circumstances. Why? Because his source is not in what is happening around him. It doesn't matter that the wind blows, he is rooted deep. It doesn't matter that it doesn't rain, he's got a source. And so with his meaning and his purpose and identity and his strength rooted in God's order, it tells us he will prosper. Not he might prosper, not he could prosper. Not that's probably the best way to do it among all the other options that are out there. No, he will prosper. God will carry him. Now the opposite image that's given to us is the image of the chaff. Now, this is where we just go. Most of us do not produce our own grain. Chaff is the husks on the grain, and they need to be removed or separated from the wheat so that it could be used. And so the chaff is the unusable part. It's the part you want to get rid of so that you can get the seed. And so the first part of this is threshing, where they will basically rub the husks off of the seed. And all of this would fall into a big pile. And so you would have all the good stuff and the bad stuff all together in this giant pile. And then what they would do is they would throw this up in the air. And what happened is they throw this all up in the air is the seeds, because they are heavier, would fall back down and the chaff would be carried away by the wind. So that's their way of separating the good from the bad in this time. And so it's telling us that the wicked man is like the chaff, taken away by the wind, right? In other words, the wicked are Well, they're driven by what is going on around them. They're entirely controlled by their environment. Their cares are in this world, and this world is always changing, and so their cares are always changing. And just a bit of wind, they get carried away. They have no ability to weather the storms of life because life is what justifies them. When stuff is hard, their life is terrible. When stuff is going well, their life is great. But they sort of ride that roller coaster of life. And any of you who have ridden that roller coaster, it's a terrible roller coaster. It's exhausting. Especially if you get on a really bad downswing. If life is all there is, then you live and you die by your experiences. And so this is talking about lifelong results, not just the moment. And I say that because the faithful will, like the unfaithful, experience things in this life that overwhelm and cause fear and, as we said, produce great doubt. But for the Christian, that is a moment of disorientation. It's a moment where we have to sit and go, this isn't how I thought it was going to go. I thought I was doing the right thing. God, I thought I knew who you were. Now I need to rethink that. And for those who belong to God, there is a process of reorientation. That is the good news. Our reorientation comes from knowing how we connect to the stream. It comes from finding our place in this world not based on ourselves, not based on just what has been sort of given to us in a temporary realm. Our lives are based on who we are rooted in. And so the psalmist ends this by saying, let me show you where this goes. Let me show you the eventual end of this. No matter where you are right now in life, no matter what is going on in this moment, let me show you where this leads. This is what he says, verse 5. He says, therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. So while there's a blessedness that you experience in this life, ultimately, our expectations, our ultimate blessedness will never be met while we are still here and alive. As Christians, we have to live this life with an orientation of hope. Again, continually going through that process of disorientation, reorientation, continually delighting in what God says is good and true as we await a future that is secure, has been secured by Jesus Christ. It tells us here, this way of the righteous is known by God. And that doesn't just mean known like he has a general idea of what's going to happen. It's known by him because he wrote it. He earned it. He's the one who's carrying it out. Known means it is sure. There is no other way that this could go. The Lord knows the way of the righteous, and so we can be secure and blessed because we know where our life is going. Again, no matter how bad things get in any specific moment. Alternatively, here the psalmist says, the way of the wicked will perish. I think it's intentional that the first word of the psalm is blessed and the last word is perish. It's setting us up for sort of the two options in this life. And while all the complexities of this life make us believe that there are numerous paths, the truth is you are either delighting in God, singing his praises on a path to blessedness, or you are scoffing at him on the way to destruction. And while it's hard to see God's way as prospering sometimes, I'm just going to keep coming back to this. There are times where what you are going through, you look at it and you're like, is this blessed? Is this what good looks like? Because it doesn't feel like it right now. The truth is, God is with us through that. That's what we hold on to, knowing that he will bring us through and he will accomplish exactly what he has promised us here. God has ordered this world to function in a particular way to draw us to himself in praise. And so the question that this whole psalm sets up for us is, are you going to trust him? Are you willing to put your faith in God? Not like, I'm going to hedge my bets. I'll give a little bit to God, diversify my accounts, put a little bit over. No. Are you going to trust him? Are you going to say, his way is good, and I am going to do it, and I am going to practice it, and I am going to force myself into his way, even when I'm not really sure where it's going to go? Or are you going to follow the wisdom of the world? Are you going to seek fulfillment in everything else? Ultimately, are you going to set yourself against God? Like, will you build a root system that can sustain you? Or are you going to be like the chaff that is blown away by every wind of change? And so we come here, we gather together as a church every week to be reminded of why his way is better, to see what blessedness truly means, and to partake in the physical acts that he has given to help reorient us. And so when we come to the table in communion, one of the things that we are declaring every week is, I have been disoriented this week. My life didn't go as planned. People let me down. If I'm honest, I let other people down. I'm having a hard time, God, really understanding where the good is in all of this. And then you bring that to him. And as you take the bread, representing the broken body of Jesus Christ, and when you grab the cup representing his blood, you are ultimately saying, I am giving this all to you. I am taking on your way. You are declaring, if you can save your people through the death of your son, I trust you to do good in my life. I root myself in you. And so come forward today to the table to find blessedness and delight in the way of God. Let's pray.